Hey everybody, let me remind you one more time about my new blueprint for success. It's a project I've spent months and months working on just to help you jumpstart your comedy career and beat the competition. Whether you want to do stand-up, sketch, improv, acting, writing, producing, directing, radio, social media influencing, or even if you want a career behind the scenes as a manager or agent, Blueprint for Success will give you all the tools you need to take your career to the highest levels. With exclusive interviews, my top 50 commercial-free episodes from industry standard, one-on-one coaching with me, and unprecedented access into my knowledge and experience from over 40 years in this crazy business, I guarantee you that with Blueprint for Success, you'll become the creator you've always dreamed of becoming. No one's asking me to do this. I want to do it because I want to help you become truly undeniable. So just go to barrykatz.com, click on Blueprint for Success, and start your incredible journey today. I truly can't wait to work with you to help you change the trajectory of your comedy career forever.
I didn't know what to do. And if I'd had somebody, I mean, my father, I told my father and he's like, well, maybe if you go back and ask, they'll give you your job back. I'm like, yeah, but they threw me out and they've mistreated me. And he's like, well, you can maybe get your job back. And I was like, that's not what I wanted to hear. I think like I didn't have anybody offering me some advice. And that really, that was something that I wish I had. I wish I had a Barry Katz who would say, hey, do this or do that, or why don't you give this a try? Or maybe you're not seeing it from this point of view.
Welcome back to another episode of Industry Standard with me, Barry Katz. Very excited. My guest today probably needs no introduction, but I'm going to give him one anyway. As far as all the guests I've ever had on this program, and I've had a lot of great guests, I don't think there's anybody that I've had who has done more different things successfully than Gavin Pallone. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about him. It's going to be a little bit long. He may fall asleep on the couch, but I am going to give him the proper introduction.
It's okay. You're going through my favorite topic. So go.
Your favorite topic.
I will stay interested.
Is you. You know, I always say, you know, I don't like dating because I don't like hearing my life story over and over again. But anyway, at 22 years old, Gavin Pallone was already bored with being an assistant at ICM, so he applied to join the CIA, who turned him down, probably the only time that anybody ever passed on him. Reading Variety online one afternoon, he saw a story about a potential network pickup for the fall TV season, which failed to mention his NBC pilot, Dots, D period, O period, T period, S period. What did he do? He instantly picked up the phone and called Variety and the reporter and complained. Next day, Pallone's show was a big story, and that's because of his persistence. Let me tell you a little bit about him. I told you he began his career as an assistant at ICM, but he left there and he went to join Bauer Benedek, a leading boutique agency, which evolved into United Talent Agency, where Pallone was made partner at the young age of 29. While at UTA, he served as head of the talent department until abandoning his career as an agent in 1996, which we'll talk about, when he partnered with Judy Hufflin to form Hufflin Pallone, a talent management and production company. Through that company, he became an executive producer on the Emmy-nominated HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm, as well as the CW's Gilmore Girls, which I believe went more than 150 episodes. In the summer of 2001, Pallone formed the production company Pariah, which was named after something he believes he represents. He produced numerous television shows under that banner, including Revelations for NBC, Tell Me You Love Me for HBO, My Boys for TBS, The Bachelorette Party for Oxygen, and Jane by Design and Twisted for ABC Family. In feature films, Gavin has produced When Trumpets Fade for HBO, Drop Dead Gorgeous for New Line, Stir of Echoes for Artisan, Premium Rush, Panic Room, which I believe made over $200 million worldwide, Secret Window, and Zombieland for Columbia Pictures. And the independent features Conan O'Brien Can't Stop and Seeing Other People, starring Jay Moore. I remember that. Little Manhattan and My Super Ex-Girlfriend, which I happen to love, for New Regency and 20th Century Fox. Primeval for Disney. Ghost Town for DreamWorks. Pallone has also, get this, directed. Yes, there's more that he does. Multiple episodes of Jane by Design and Twisted. And more importantly, recently he's written numerous unbelievable articles for publications like The Hollywood Reporter, GQ, and he currently writes a regular column for New York Magazine that you must check out. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome my guest today. I am so excited about it, Gavin Pallone.
Thank you for having me, Barry.
All right. I'm so glad you're here.
I feel so validated. You know, before I walked in, I'm like, oh, I'm such a loser. And then you go through that whole thing. Hey, I'm not that bad, am I?
I know the people listening sometimes who are in studio apartments somewhere in the world thinking, how am I going to get my life going? They look in the mirror sometimes and they think, God, I'm such a loser. I'm never going to get something going. Could you let our audience know how it's possible for somebody to do as many things as you've done and still get up and look in the mirror sometimes and think, you know what? I haven't done it all yet. I feel like I'm not valid.
Because it's about perspective. Everybody, you know, loses perspective. It's kind of the human condition. But in a certain way, that drives us forward to say, look, I want to succeed. That's a primordial desire that we all have. And part of the impetus to do that is to think we don't have enough. And I think it makes us crazy in some regard. And at the same time, it probably makes us successful. If you feel like I'm not doing as well as that other guy, if I don't feel like I've produced enough movies, or I don't like my writing, or I don't think that some other part of my life is as good as it can be, I'm driven forward partially by that skewed perspective that I haven't been successful enough. And you can always find somebody else to compare yourself to who's done better, you know? And I think also if you do stuff like I do, where I want to do a lot of different things because I find that most enjoyable and I'm not focused on any one thing, I'm probably going to do okay in those lot of things because I'm dividing my time and attention and maybe less good in any one of them. But at the same time, you know, I'd rather have it be that way. I know that if I pull out and I have a wider perspective, but when you get narrow and you go, you see somebody who produces a movie who I think is untalented and then that's successful, and you're like, oh, why am I not more successful at that? Or any of a number of things.
I think that when I used to work, something you don't know about me, I used to work with disabled kids and adults when I was a teenager for like 5 years until I was 20. And I worked with some of the most severely disabled kids and adults. I worked with a kid who had no arms and no legs and used to go swimming. I don't know how he did it. And he'd look around and I could tell he was looking around saying, hey, there's a kid who's worse off than me. There's right. a kid that's better off than me. Mm-hmm. And I remember that and I thought, God, is this true in business? And now, as I'm in it, I realize, yes, it is. Mm-hmm. And so you've talked a lot about this in a lot of your articles about the trajectory of business. But before we get into that, I want to go way, way back, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So take me back to where you grew up, what your family life was like, and what was your first inspiration to say, I want to be in the entertainment business?
I grew up in Encino. My parents were divorced when I was about 13, 14. I lived with my father and he moved to Beverly Hills.
Now that's a critical time, 13, 14.
It was liberating to me. I didn't like my mother. I didn't like my sister. I wanted more freedom. I was going to a school I didn't really want to go to. And then my parents' divorce kind of freed me of all of that. I was going to a private school I didn't like. And my father, you know, we moved. I was able to get out of that private school because he was thinking, oh, this is better for my son. He was just thinking it was cheaper for me to go to public school, which was better for me.
So you went to public school.
I went to public school. I went to Beverly Hills High School. I'm not going to say that I went to some kind of credit and go downtown somewhere. You know, but
who were some of the kids at Beverly Hills High School that are in the business today?
Oh, in my class. It's funny because there's a bunch of them, like not people that were necessarily my friends, but Nicolas Cage was in my class. And there are other people, you know, whose names I don't want to mention that I'm not friendly with. But, you know, there's a lot of people from the entertainment business that I went to school with. But I didn't want to be in the entertainment industry. I really had no interest in that. Even after I was in it, I wasn't interested in it. When I went to college, I was planning on getting into real estate. And I...
Does anyone go to college for real estate?
I only went to college because my father said I had to go to college, and I just wanted to get out as soon as possible. So I graduated in 3 years. During my last year in college, I took my real estate broker's, you know, test, and I passed it. And after I went on, you know, the trip with a friend, I came back to Los Angeles, and I was living in my father's apartment, and it was dismal. And I had applied for a job at Coldwell Banker to be a real estate agent, which is what I had really wanted to do. Now, I had studied film in college, mostly just because I liked movies.
Where'd you go to college?
UC Berkeley. And so not for any other reason than that. And, you know, my mother, who I was not that close to, but she made TV movies. So she was sort of tangentially in she was in the entertainment business. And she said, well, why don't you consider it? I mean, you studied film. And I thought, oh, maybe, but I really want to be in real estate. And she had a friend of hers meet with me, who a man named Jeff Sagansky, who's a very important executive and still is today.
Where was he at the time?
He was the president of TriStar Pictures.
Got it.
And I went and met with him, and I said, I don't know, maybe I would want to be like a script reader or something on the way to being an executive. And he said, you should be a talent agent. That's where you learn everything. They're at the center of the business. I was like, all right, okay. So then I got a meeting at the William Morris Agency just to sort of follow up on that.
I think what's fascinating, I'm sorry to interrupt, but this is what's interesting about your life so far that people don't realize sometimes. You grow up and you have no control over where you're born, who your parents are, where you live. It just happens. Mm-hmm. And you said you had a divorce that happened when you were 13. You have no control over that. You believe it's a great thing because you get to go with your dad and get away a little bit from your mom, who you're not getting along with.
No, I didn't. And he gave me a moped. I mean, he did everything wrong, like the things you shouldn't do with a kid. I'm 13, 14 years old. I have a moped. I didn't have a helmet. He didn't ever pay attention to how late I was. I'd come home at 2 a.m. He didn't pay attention. It's like basically I just had a roommate. And then I got to get out of this old boys school I was going to and go be in a school with girls. And it was like, It was unbelievable how much my life had improved.
But this is the thing that's, to me, that's really fascinating. Your mom, who you weren't really getting along with, who wasn't really inspiring you, and your dad, who gave you that freedom, it was actually your mom that made the introduction into this business and why we're listening to you and why you've had such a long career, is because everybody needs that one introduction into the affiliation. Mm-hmm. And she put you in front of a guy who was the president of TriStar Pictures.
Yeah.
And for those of you listening, if you're anybody in the business and you think you can get an interview or a meeting with somebody from the president of TriStar or any organization, it's like literally 1 in 100,000 shot that you're going to get that meeting if you've never done anything in your life.
And let me stop you right here. I will not meet with anybody who calls me and says, hey, I know that you got your break because you got this meeting with Jeff Sagansky, so why don't you pay it back and meet with me? And I will not do that, Barry.
I'm
telling anybody listening, I will not. Don't call my office. Don't try to, you know, send me a message on Facebook.
Now,
don't wait outside my building. It will not happen.
Why is that?
If I had to do it over again, I would have just kept on my path and gotten into real estate. I think that would have been much better.
Well, every real estate agent I know is about, between the ages of 40 and dead. So I think you can actually go into it now if you want to. That'll be the seventh thing you've done.
I'm actually between those ages too, Barry. Here's what ended up happening was, I went and had this meeting at the William Morris Agency, and I met with some super arrogant guy who was telling me, like, most people wash out of their training program and, you know, we only take the best of the best, and, you know, you're going to work for like $280 a week and 14 hours a day and all of that. And I was really unimpressed with the whole thing, and I just said, forget it. So I was just planning on going.
Do you want to explain what the training room and the training program is at William Morris, if you haven't read
William Morris
books?
And I think these things still exist at the major agencies, although I think there is some limits to how they work people or maybe they pay them a little better now. But basically they got sort of slave labor back then, where you'd work your ass off for no money. You start in the mailroom and you deliver packages, and back then you copied scripts, which were typed on a typewriter back then, you know, so there was a lot more manual labor that was involved in the business because we didn't have things like the internet. And so they would, you know, hire these people, a lot of whom, you know, came out of really good colleges, kind of a combination of people who were high achieving and people who were related to someone important. Those are the people that generally got into those programs. I
I didn't want to do that. And then you would work your way up, then you'd become an assistant to somebody. And then ideally, if you'd done that long enough, maybe you'd get to be, you know, 3-4 years later, they'd promote you to being a talent agent, or they'd fire you. So, but you will get a good education in the entertainment industry. That is true. And what Jeff said was true, that the agency business is the center of the business in terms of the flow of information. So I didn't want to do it. And I was going to just go forward and become a real estate agent. And I went to a party at a friend's house, and her uncle, who I had met before, had been a movie producer, though he hadn't really been working that much around that time. And his wife was a talent agent at a small agency. And I became friendly with her. And then we were there, and I told them my whole story. And they said, no, you should definitely go into the agency business. And I said, no, that guy was an asshole. And, you know, I want to be in real estate, and this sounds stupid, and I'm not interested. Then about, you know, I was waiting for my meeting, which was very far in the future for me, like 3-4 weeks in the future. And I was waiting for this meeting at Coldwell Banker to become a real estate agent. And that woman, whose name was Marcy Glenn, called me at home at like 10:30 in the morning and woke me up, because that had nothing to do. And she said, hey, I'm leaving my small agency to go be an agent at ICM. Do you want to come be my assistant? And I said, I don't know how to type. And she said, well, you can learn how to type. I said, okay.
You know, what's odd is that's probably the last time you ever woke up at 10:30 in the morning.
Probably. And, you know, I just went and took the job because I didn't have a job and someone was willing to pay me. And I wanted to get the hell out of my father's apartment, basically. And so I took the job, but I still didn't really think that was where I was going to be. I thought I was going to end up doing something else. I thought I just needed a job because I didn't have, all my friends were still in school. I graduated from college early and I just had nothing else to do. And then
her clients in the literary world or in the acting
world? Actors. Like her biggest client was Stephanie Zimbalist, who was on Remington Steele at the time.
So she represented the more, because this is a weird thing that people don't understand. And normally it's not the bigger agencies, but normally there's a really interesting boutique business in representing actors who are like that, who have been doing it like 20, 30, 40 years, and you have that group of clients and you're known as the go-to person for that group of people. Mm-hmm. Not to say that it's always the most respected way to go, but that's a lot of things mm-hmm. happen for people like that.
Yeah. So I went to work there and I didn't really like it. And they didn't have the mailroom system that they had at William Morris. So most of the people who just worked on people's desks were, you know, people who, that's their job. And that was my job.
That's interesting that ICM didn't have the mailroom, because they were obviously one of the top five agencies at the time back then, even.
No, they were top, there was three.
Three, yeah.
Yeah, they didn't do that. Although down the road, they eventually, you know, picked up that model. But the people at the time I worked there worked in the mailroom. That was their job. That was their profession, a professional mailroom kind of person. So anyway, I kind of just thought I would go along with that and see what happened and maybe eventually transition, get somewhere in the real estate thing, come back to it. But when I got there, I did realize that it would be better, and I think Marcy told me this, to at least say that I wanted to be a talent agent, because you'd be treated with more respect rather than someone who's just a secretary. I didn't want to be someone's secretary when I was, you know, I'd just turned 21 years old. And so I did that. And I used to work hard and stay late because I had no friends, because all my friends were still in college. So that made me stand out a little bit more. And then
it always does.
Yeah. And then I still was looking to get out. I just couldn't, I didn't like it. And that's, you know, as you mentioned, I applied to the CIA. I tried to get a job at Warner Brothers in their TV movie department. I got dinged for that. It didn't happen. I came very close to getting a job at ABC in the current department. Didn't get it.
Here's an interesting question.
And so I was kind of like stuck.
Why do you think, you know, Bernie Brillstein used to say that people in his profession were they were just unhirable. Mm-hmm. What do you think it was about your interviewing skills or style where you, I'm not saying you interviewed for the CIA, that was probably an application, but another area.
No, I had an interview.
Oh, so.
I got past the interview stage. That wasn't where I just didn't have any skills that they were looking for when I.
So in other words, you think you were a great interviewer, but you just didn't have the skill set.
For the CIA?
And the other things that you.
Well, it was a little different. For the CIA, I think they were looking for native speakers of a language. Like, I mean, I had a good interview and then I went and took the test and they told me I scored highly on the test. But when I went to the test, which was held at UCLA, a proctored test, most everybody in the room was obviously either first generation American or had been born in some other country. So I think they were looking for somebody who was from Thailand, who spoke fluent Thai, that they could then place in Thailand,
or they were people with buzz cuts who were clearly in the military. And then there was me with, you know, shoulder length, long hair and a beard. So, you know, it didn't really look right. But in the for the other things, actually, no, I came really close to getting the jobs. It just I don't even know if I was 22 yet, or I maybe turned 22. So the people I was up against had a lot more experience, and I just didn't get those jobs. I might have if I had hung in longer, but I decided to apply myself and try to see if I could get to be an agent so that I could then still transition out. I didn't want to be an agent at that time because I had worked for Marcy for a period of time, which was kind of unfulfilling, and I moved over and worked for another agent in the literary department who represented mostly writers, named Howie Klein, who I'm sure you know.
Who became a manager and a partner at 3 Arts.
Yeah. Yeah. Great guy.
And so you were on his desk, and that's when you started reading scripts for the first time.
Yeah, I read a lot of scripts, and I would summarize those scripts for Howie. And he gave me a lot of responsibility, which was terrific. I was working really late. I got to be the departmental assistant, which put me sort of in the mix with the other agents and the head of the department, because I would be the one taking notes in the meeting, which was very different back then, because as you remember, and probably a lot of the people who listen to this podcast don't know, like, we didn't have computers, and there were computers in the world, but it's like ICM didn't have them. So I would have to type. So you would do a status document of every project out there. And then everybody would talk about who was being submitted for what project, you know, so what writers were being submitted for Hunter or Heart to Heart or something like that. And today you would just go, they would make changes on it. Oh, here's what they're looking for: a producer. They're looking for a story editor level person. And you would type that up on your computer, and it would take you like 4 minutes to make the changes after you did it, or you just do it there in the meeting. I would have to write everything down and then go back and stay there till 10:30 at night, retyping the whole 16-page document because we didn't have a computer.
You know? For Gavin, a multi-million-dollar company who has since gone out of business would be the Whiteout company.
Oh, I used tons of Whiteout and the tape and all of that stuff. So, I got a lot of experience, and also because Howie would actually give me like his clients' contracts and ask me to read them over and give him notes on it, which was great. So I really learned about, you know, contracts and negotiating. I think to this day, still talent agents have their assistants listening in on phone calls, which I always felt was a very kind of suspect practice, but you really learn, you know, everything about the business that way. And so I think
it is a weird practice, and it happens all the time. They used to have the phones, if you remember, Gavin, that you on the handset, they'd have like a little switch on it where you could press it and you could listen or not listen. And I always thought that it was so weird because, you know, you're doing something that's illegal. You know, I don't think Nicolas Cage wants the assistant listening on the phone, but it's not said, hey, Nicholas, by the way, I have my assistant on the phone with me.
Right.
It's just they're always listening, and I think it's a violation of privacy tremendously, but every agency did it.
Oh, and still does it. People still do it. Actually, it's also more interesting is that even later than that, when I started as an assistant, I think nobody had cell phones even yet. But then
they had the ones the size of a brick.
Yeah, there was a couple. I remember at ICM, Jeff Berg had
the Wall Street.
He had those
on
gigantic
the beach
cell phones. But eventually, everybody got cell phones and had cell phones in their car, and you would have your assistant run calls for you while you're on the phone. So you would call into your office, and the assistant would just go from one call to the other. But they didn't have back then the technology to cut off each individual call. So sometimes, and you probably remember this, like I actually would just stay, you know, after I became an agent, he would hold on to some people's calls. And so this is really, you know, I'm hoping he doesn't listen to your podcast or find out this, but I remember a couple of times Jeff Katzenberg would call me, and then I would talk to him and get off. But I would just hit mute, and I would listen to Jeff Katzenberg's calls for half an hour and just keep listening to everything that was going on with Jeff Katzenberg. And there's another agent in, if he listens to your podcast, he'll know who he is, who would listen to the head of a major studio continue to run his calls, and then heard an inappropriate conversation between him and his assistant, who he was obviously having an affair with. This was a married guy. That was a lot of fun back then. You know, technology has really taken the fun out of the entertainment business, I have to tell you.
That's fantastic. That's great. Jeffrey Katzenberg, one of my favorite quotes of his, if you don't come in Saturday, don't bother coming in on Sunday.
And it's true.
Which is true of your career, because you got there early, you stayed late, and that's how you gain people's trust and Howie's trust. And so what happened after that?
I just was totally sick of it. After I'd been an assistant for about 15 months, I just couldn't take anymore, which isn't a long time. And I sort of just set a time limit for myself that whatever the end of the year was, if I don't get promoted, I'm going to leave.
Now, did you ask? Did you go to Howie Klein and say, Howie, you know, I've been here for 3 years.
I'd only been there 15 months. I was very impatient.
Oh, 15 months.
Yeah.
But did you go to him and say, like, when do you think I might be promoted? Or did you just keep it to yourself?
No, I would talk to Howie about it, you know, to the extent that I could. But Howie was supportive. It wasn't, and he wasn't really fully up to him. So it was really about the head of the department, you know, agreeing that I could get promoted. But in the interim period, they created a training program. And they had they didn't go to the mailroom kind of model, but at that particular point, they just said, we got to have our own training program. And so they sort of decided that they would make one assistant. They take one assistant from each department, like from the motion picture talent department, the TV talent department, the TV lit department, which was what I was in, and whatever else. And they would make, you know, each of those people the trainee. And I got made the trainee for the television lit department. But they didn't have anything for us to do. So I got an office on a lower floor. And I was put in an office, and I shared it with a woman named Carol Bodie, if you know her.
Of course.
And she was Steve Dontonville's assistant. And we were just in this office, and it's like, well, what are we going to do? Like, they didn't tell us what to do. So we just made ourselves agents, in a sense. And so I signed people. Nobody asked me or told me what I was supposed to do. And Carol did the same thing. So she'd have her little actor clients, and I'd have people who would just send in scripts. And I signed a friend of mine's boyfriend and things like that. And then I'd have all the information about what projects were looking for writers and where you could sell stuff. I mean, I'd been listening and I knew what to do. And then what we would do, because we didn't have an assistant or anything like that, but to make ourselves look official, Carol and I would answer each other's phones. So Carol would go Gavin Pallone's office, and I would say Carol Bodie's office. So it seemed like Carol Bodie had, you know, an assistant, and it would seem like I had an assistant, which would make us legitimate. And slowly I would sign a few people, and eventually those people got jobs.
Who was the first client of yours to get a job? Before you answer that, I just want to let our audience know Carol Bodie is a great agent at ICM. She represented a variety of great film stars, and you know, one of her biggest clients at the time, I remember, was Winona Ryder, mm-hmm. and Steve Dottenville.
John Hamm she represented.
That's Stone. Right. And Steve Dottenville was probably one of the greatest agents there ever was.
Yeah, he represented a lot of great people.
So I just wanted to say that before you went on.
And yeah, so, you know, we started doing that, but then at some point they did promote me and I was made an agent pretty soon after that. And, you know, what they do is they give you territory to cover. So I had TV studios that I'd have to go cover. My problem was I really wasn't a social person, and it was really hard. And there's not a lot of hand holding, hey, let me teach you how to do this at that time at ICM. You know, I'm supposed to make phone calls. I'm supposed to kind of like somehow find my own clients, although it's unsaid. And I'm supposed to be pitching other people's clients. And I would get really nervous. Like, I remember calling the first person I called, who was a TV movie writer, to see if they'd be interested in my signing them. And I was sweating, and I would look at the phone and I wouldn't dial it. And then I eventually do it. And I just panicked out of my mind. And even when I would go have to have lunch, you know, you have to go out and you have an expense account. And you have to go take the buyers to lunch. So you go find, you know, you go to lunch with a producer or a studio executive or a network executive. I'd be like, I don't know what to say. I wouldn't know what to talk about. Cause you know, you have like a couple minutes of, well, what projects are you looking for writers on? And that takes like 4 minutes. Now I got to sit at lunch with somebody. I don't know how to do that. And I remember back then, you know, like an early, you know, Alan Berger was the head of the television department, who's still an agent at CAA. And my first expense account, I remember I turned in an expense account, and my expense report was $140. And he calls me in his office, and he's like, you have an expense report. Like, why are you not taking people out? Why are you spending $140? And I said, you know, I just not the kind of person who wants to sit at lunch with somebody. You know, and he just stared at me and he's like, that's not going to work, you know. So I realized that was a little problematic, and I started amping that up, but I would still feel uncomfortable. So I would go to lunch, and as soon as it's down, I'd try to get the waiter over so we could order to chew up time immediately. And they'd say, I have to go to the bathroom.
And I'm not joking. I'd go stand in the bathroom. And I did this once with a woman who eventually became my, who I started dating. And she told me later that she remembered it. I just said I was really nervous. I didn't want to sit and talk. And I tried to chew up time by spending like 10 minutes in the bathroom. And she thought maybe I had a cocaine problem or something, because like I was going to go to the bathroom to use coke.
Well, clearly it worked. I mean, so for all you out there, when it comes to dating and you're on a first date, go to the bathroom for 10 minutes.
It's amazing that I ever succeeded as an agent or got a date. But yeah, that was the kind of thing I had to sort of fight my way through.
Hey, everybody. I hope you're enjoying this episode as much as I am. If you made it this far and you haven't fallen asleep yet, then you must be the type of person who's serious about having a career in the comedy business. That's why I'm offering you my blueprint for success, a one-of-a-kind all-access pass into my knowledge and experience after over 40 years of working with the best of the best in this crazy entertainment industry. I'll tell you all the stories, all the philosophies, give you all the great special guests, and even give you one-on-one private consultations to help you expand, enhance, and skyrocket your comedy career. Just go to barrykatz.com and click on Blueprint for Success to learn more about my groundbreaking digital academy that I've created just for you. With it, we can take your career so far that one day, instead of listening to this podcast, you'll be interviewed on it.
And the first client that you ever got a job for, what was the job? What happened? So you knew, I can do this.
I think I sold a script that actually eventually got made, a guy named Jonathan Tidor. And it eventually became a movie called I Come in Peace with Dolph Lundgren. And I sold that script to, I don't even remember what the name of the company was, some cheesy, you know, kind of company, like a Canon-esque kind of company. But, you know, early on, I was able to get some traction, and I sold a few features really early in the game. I remember I signed, this is like right when the beginning, when I was an agent, I signed a writer who's a big writer director named David Goyer, and I sold his first script. And he was working as a guy who delivers soda at the CBS MTM lot. And I took the script of his, I think it was called Lethal Contact or something. I seem to be very involved in violent movies. And I remember I took it and I went down to Jack Gilardi, who was an old time agent who represented a lot of, you know, kind of very iconic.
I think old-timey, he's still there.
He's probably still there at 150. And I went to him and I got him to give the script to Jean-Claude Van Damme. And then we did get it set up at Canon. And that was the first thing that David Goyer sold. And, so I had, it was like that. And I had a couple writers on the new Smothers Brothers show. And then that was one of the only shows that stayed working during the 1988 strike. And during that period of time,
that was the writer's strike.
The writer's strike. So the business sort of was like shutting down, and I had some traction. And maybe that was around the time that my former boss, Howie Klein, left. He went to become a manager. And that kind of really helped my career a lot, because he left to be a manager, which is a non-competitive situation with the agency, and the agency wanted to keep his clients. And I was the only one who kind of knew them because I had been his assistant. So we tried to keep a lot of his clients, and I kept, you know, some of them, not all of them. But, you know, a couple of them, the most important ones were a couple guys named Al Jean and Mike Reese, who were at the time writers on ALF and then became writers on It's Gary Shandling Show.
And ALF was a show that Bernie Brillstein sold, I believe.
Yeah, and It's Gary Shandling Show was also a Brillstein show. And so that really helped, because prior to that, you know, I'm signing people who had never done anything before, like, as I mentioned, David Goyer, or I signed probably the biggest writer in the world, a guy named David Kep, who's one of my closest friends, but he had never done anything. And I had sold a script of his that also got made, called Bad Influence, back then. But, you know, there's only so far you can get if you're only signing people who've not done anything. And after I had Mike and Al, who I got from Howie, and maybe a couple other of his clients, it made it a lot easier, because, you know, I'd go try to sign someone and they'd say, well, you know, the first thing they're going to ask you, because I was young, who do you represent? And I'd say, well, you know, this guy who sold a cheesy action movie, and another guy who did a rewrite for another cheesy company, and, you know, they don't want to sign with you. But then when you have people go, oh, these guys who are on It's Gary Shandling Show, and maybe the staff writers on another thing, I had like two or three or four clients. And then I was able to sort of build from there. So at that point, there was kind of a critical mass that allowed me to propel myself forward and sign other people, and also getting over the whole, you know, shyness thing that I had, and be a little bit more forceful and a little more confident. And then my career kind of went pretty well after that.
Yeah. So how do you end up at Bauer Benedict?
Well, when I was about 25, again, you know, I was very naive and I never had a mentor, which really is, I think, kind of did me in a lot of ways.
So you didn't feel like Howie was a mentor, Howie Klein?
Well, Howie left, you know, and we didn't have that kind of a relationship, really. I mean, I do owe a lot to him, but it wasn't the thing where he's like, you know, hey, do this, don't do that. And I didn't really have a father who was like that. To some extent, the people who I felt like could have been my mentor, like Howie, left and did something else. And then the other one was Bill Block, who was at the time the head of the motion picture lit department. And he had sort of promised that he was going to bring me into the motion picture department because I was doing a lot of movie stuff and I wanted to get out of the TV department. The other agents there were kind of difficult and would try to steal my little clients who away from me internally in the inside the agency. Like literally people who worked down the hall would go up to my clients and say, don't you think you should have a more, you know, experienced agent and take my clients? Most notably a guy named Scott Schwartz, who I still see all the time. And so I wanted to move in, and I really liked Bill, and I wanted to be like Bill. He had a Porsche. That was like my dream. And then Bill left to start an agency called Intertalent. So now I'm kind of adrift inside the agency, and I had a contract that was running up. I had been making, I think, $60,000 a year. This is 1989. And my contract's coming up. And I'd never met anybody at any other agencies. But I now had like this group of writers. I had signed some more people. I had people on The Simpsons. Gina Reese went over to The Simpsons. And then I also had Kogan and Wolodarski who were on The Simpsons. And I had signed a bunch more people.
And relationships, because Wally Wolodarski is who wrote the movie Seeing Other People, which you produced.
Directed, yeah. And then, you know, those guys were starting to take off. And people had called me. And I was running towards the end of my contract, but I wanted to stay at ICM. I mean, it's, when you're at a talent agency, you don't want to do anything that might disrupt the trajectory you're on. And the one thing that could disrupt it is like, if you leave, then all your clients have to make a new decision. Are they going to come with you or they're not going to come with you? And I had a meeting.
Did you worry about that when you left?
Yeah.
So even back then you were feeling insecure that even if I go someplace, I'm not enough.
Oh, yeah. But I was going to stay. My plan was to stay. I just was trying to see if I could move into the movie business, which the TV people knew about, because Bill Block tried to do it before he left and they wouldn't allow it. And then he left and Jeremy Zimmer took over the motion picture lit department, and he hated me and was really mean and abusive to me and would yell at me. And so that was really kind of a drag. But I still felt like I wanted to stay because I didn't want to lose my clients and because it's all that I knew.
Now, remember that sentence about Jeremy Zimmer and yelling, and because that's going to come into play later on.
So I was negotiating, and I really wanted to make $100,000 a year. And
what were you making at the time?
60. And you know, this is 1989. I was 25. And it was like, that's a lot of money back then. And we were negotiating, and they offered me 80, and it was going back and forth. And during that period of time, I did have a meeting at CAA with the people in the TV department, and they wanted to bring me over. But I had the first meeting with the people who ran the TV.
Do you remember the agents in the meeting?
It was a guy named Mark Rosen and Abby Spiegel. And they ran the TV lit department, and they said, and I said, I like to do both TV and features. And I have a few feature clients who seem to be taking off, notably like David Kep and David Goyer and a couple others. And they said, oh, well, you'd have to let the feature people handle that. We're too busy in TV, and you'd have too much to do in TV. At that point, I just said, I'm not doing it. I know internally, I didn't say that to them. I'm not doing it. And then they called me and said, hey, you know, we really liked you. We'd like you to meet with Lee Gabler if you're really serious about doing this. And he ran all of the whole TV department. And I said, no, I don't want to do it. So I'd already said no to CAA.
The power of no.
Yeah. I just didn't. I wanted to stay, but I wanted to get a better deal. And I think they had offered me 80, and I'm still pushing for 100. And I'm also pushing to get Jeremy to not be so mean to me. And, you know, negotiations kept going on and dragging, and I was dragging it on. And I wanted to have a couple, at least one other meeting with another agency. And there was this small agency called Bauer Benedek, you know, like six people, but they had a lot of big time clients back then. So it was small. They mostly did features. I knew one guy who had worked at ICM named Marty Hurwitz, who became, who went over to work in television. But they, you know, they had big marquee clients like Michael J. Fox at that particular time when he was, you know, doing Back to the Future and he was at his peak, and Brian De Palma and Larry Kasdan when they were at their peak. I mean, so they had big clients. So that seemed really cool, like to not be in a big sort of nest of vipers like I was when I was at ICM, and maybe I could contribute there. So I got a meeting with them through some lawyers, and I had one meeting with them and it went really well. But at the end, I still thought, I'm not going to leave. And the negotiations went on. I think they went up to 90,000. And at that time, this guy, Scott Schwartz, went and told them that he thought I was, he heard that I was leaving to go to CAA. He told the, my boss that.
And what happens in the business, for those of you listening, is no matter what you think you're doing, no matter where you are, where you think that no one is going to know anything or what it is, you always have to walk through a hallway somewhere, and there's always somebody looking, taking note, and starting a rumor or gossiping. No matter what you do, you could meet in a private vault, mm-hmm. and there'd be somebody at a front desk of a hotel that saw something that could say something to somebody else.
Yeah, that's totally true. But he made it up because he didn't know if I had met with them or not, and I had already said no. So he was just trying to undermine me, have some kind of currency.
What
was
the motivation for him to be undermining you?
To take my clients, which he had already tried to do before. So then they started pressuring me, like, why aren't we signing this contract? And I said, well, I want another $10,000. And they said, well, you're not getting it. And I still had 6 weeks left on my prior contract. And they started putting, you know, I'd get more and more pressure from them. I was supposed to have a second meeting with Marty Bauer and Peter Benedek, who owned Bauer Benedek. And then all of a sudden, this thing started to crescendo, and I got a call from my biggest clients, Al Jean and Mike Reese, and they said, why is Jack Dietman calling us? And he was my boss. He was my direct superior in the TV lit department. And I said, I don't know why. He said, well, he called us to see if we could have lunch with him. And so, I mean, it was pretty clear that what he was saying is, if you're going to try to leave, I'm going to take your clients from you. So that flipped
me
out.
And Jack never told you that he was calling. He did it behind your back. What did he think?
No. And I went to him and I said, what the hell is that? And he said, I'm not going to let you leave with your clients. And I went to his boss, Alan Berger, and I said, I thought I had a couple more weeks to work out this thing. I was supposed to have dinner with Jeremy Zimmer to kind of work out our problems. And I did. And then, you know, we had this thing, and Jeremy said whatever he was instructed to say because they wanted me to stay at the agency. And I went to Alan. I said, look, this isn't fair, you know, whatever. And he said, well, we're going to give you another week or something like that, or 2 weeks. And I said,
all over $10,000.
Yeah. Well, I would have closed it, you know, right then, but I still wanted it.
$200 a week. That's all of this was over.
In the end, yes.
And why do you think that was?
Well, it related for them or for me?
For them.
Well, there was other people in my there was another guy in my department, Bob Goomer. I felt I had better clients than him. I should make more than him, but he was making 90 or 100 or whatever. It's like one of those kind of things, and they were setting precedent. And I think they felt like I was 25. So I think they felt like they had power over me, which they did. I was going to stay. I wanted to take that second meeting with Bauer Benedek, though. So I go to Berger, and he says, okay, you can stay. We'll give you 2 more weeks. Then I went back and I said to Jack, I said, well, I have 2 more weeks. And Alan said that. And he then said, you know, we'll see, or something like that. And then Jim Wyatt called me.
Or
I went down to Jim Wyatt, who was the president of the company.
So this is what's odd. You know, it's like there's a guy who's 25 years old. He's like literally sperm in the business, yet he's getting there before everybody else, leaving after everybody else, working it, banging the phones, doing everything he can, and obviously creating a situation where I like to say you were undeniable. Nobody call when your contract is up with 2 weeks left. Nobody's calling every day and having the president, Jim Wyatt of the company, walk down and talk to you.
Well, he ordered me to go down and talk to him. But anyway, I went down and talked to him, and he said, you got to sign your contract. And I said, well, I want to be in the movie department. Nobody's like, so they said, I'll get you into the movie department. I said, well, Jack's fighting me. He goes, I don't care. I'll do it. Okay. He goes, I want to think this over. I really wanted another $10,000. He says, you have 1 week. I'm coming. I'll be back from Cannes and I want your answer.
But he didn't say, I'll give you the $10,000, but he said, I'll make you a movie. I'll put you in the movie.
Yeah, he said he wouldn't give me the $10,000. I go back to my office and I said, I called Peter Benedict and I said, hey, I got to move up our meeting. It was maybe 2 weeks in advance for our second meeting, if you're interested. And he said, I don't know if I can get Marty to do that. He's going to New York or something like that. And I get a call from Jeff Berg, who's the CEO of the company.
The Jeff Berg, who just recently, in the last year and a half, formed Resolution. And if you're in the business or not in the business, after a year and a half, they're closing their doors.
And he basically said, we're not going to screw around. I want an answer from you right now. And I said, well, Jim told me I had a week. He goes, no, right now. And I said, I wouldn't agree to that. I wouldn't say yes.
And you haven't gotten your second meeting with...
No, but I didn't want to be pressured. I knew that it was unfair. Like, all these people... First, Berger told me I had 2 weeks. Then Wyatt said I had another week. And then he says, right now. And I said, no. And he goes, you know, fine, your career's over.
He said, your career's over.
Yeah, and then he hung up on me, and I locked my door, and I called my lawyer, who at the time was a guy named Eric Greenspan, who's a big music lawyer now. And and I said, they're firing me, I think. And he said, well, can't you stop that? And I said, no. They said I had to sign a contract, and I wouldn't do it. So I locked my door, and then Jack Dightman, my boss, and then the head lawyer, a guy named Bob Chuck, are like knocking on my door. And I had it locked. And
you'd think they'd have the key.
And I said, I called Peter Benedict and I go, now they're firing me. Do you want to, you have to meet with me tonight.
Now I'm surprised you said to him, now they're firing me, because doesn't that put you in a position of weakness?
I guess, but I don't know. Yeah, you're right. I mean, at the time it was like, I was just in a whirlpool. Like, it was so shocking because I didn't think any of this was going to happen.
Was it like a Jerry Maguire moment where you're calling all your clients in their locked office and saying this?
No, I did that right after because they did throw me out. So Peter said he'd find out if we could meet, and I opened my door. It's only 11 o'clock in the morning. You know, I mean, I'm not really like, none of this was planned. I thought I'd go through this process. I would maybe get an offer from Bauer Benedict, which would make me more confident, or I'd maybe use that to get the extra $10,000 I wanted from ICM. But I wasn't staying. I was for sure staying at ICM. And they came into my office and they said,
how did they get in your office?
Well, I opened the door, you know, because they were knocking, and I let them in. And outside was a guy, you know, from downstairs, like a utility guy, padlocking my files. And he said I was really unnerved. And he said, you know, we're letting you go. And I go, but I have 6 weeks left on my contract. He goes, we'll pay you for your 6 weeks and you can't work anywhere else. And I was like really angry. And I said, I can't believe you're doing this. I'm only 25, you know. And so and my assistant outside, Marsha, was crying. Like, she didn't know what was going on. She's just crying, you know. And I picked up my Rolodex and I got into the elevator.
They let you take your Rolodex?
No. Jack came out and he said, said to the lawyer, you can't take that. And I said, and the truth is, by the way, I later found out that the law was that I could take my Rolodex. This is a paper Rolodex. And I said, well, you can try to take it from me, but I'm taking it, or something like that. It was really tough at the time. And I got in the elevator and I got down to my car and I drove out out of the entrance. And every time I walk by the way, that old ICM building where Madeo is, I always go by that driveway. And I just remember that moment. I was in there and I go, where am I going? Like, am I going home? I don't know where to go. At 11 o'clock in the morning. There was no weekday 11 o'clock in the morning planned for me other than to actually work ever. And then, eventually, and then Alan Berger called and said, come back, sign a contract, and we'll just let it all go. And I said, no.
Really?
Yeah. And then I got calls from other agencies and I went and had a couple more meetings. And I ended up going to Bauer Benedict because those guys, you know, I don't even think they knew what was going on or cared. And I tried to get the $100,000 from them. And they said, no, 90. So I didn't get any more money. And but I went to go there and I think they didn't even know who I was. They didn't know who my clients were. They didn't seem to care. They were just really flush with money. And they seemed like, all right, why not? Let's take a shot.
So what's interesting is that, and I think I want you to talk to the audience about this because you obviously went with your gut, but normally when people are passionate about you, I mean, there's like six people going down to meet you or calling you to their office. The president of the fucking company says, come to my office, and gives you what you wanted, the motion picture thing. Doesn't give you the extra 10.
He said he would do it. You know, who knows?
I mean, you have to.
Everybody lied to me all the time. So
yeah, but this is, you know, the president of the company. I would hope, not to say that he hadn't lied before, but I would hope. Obviously, he believed in you. All these people believed in you. Even the people that are trying to steal your clients, or the guy who was angry and yelling at you, Jeremy Zimmer, they do that for a reason. They do it because they know you're a threat. They know you're somebody who's got something going on. Mm-hmm. So here you had a company that was passionate about you, that was your home, that believed in you. And instead, you go to a place that doesn't even know your fucking name.
Yeah.
Well, you know, again, I didn't have anybody to work any of this shit out with, you know, and again, I'm 25 years old and kind of maybe even an immature 25-year-old. Like, I didn't know what to do. And if I had had somebody, I mean, my father, I told my father, and he's like, well, maybe if you go back and ask, they'll give you your job back. I'm like, yeah, but they threw me out and they've mistreated me. And he's like, well, you can maybe get your job back. And I was like, that's not what I wanted to hear. I think, like, I didn't have anybody offering me some advice. And that really, that was something that I wish I had. I wish I had a Barry Katz who would say, hey, do this or do that, or why don't you give this a try? Or maybe you're not seeing it from this point of view. It doesn't, but you know, it worked out better for me to leave ICM for sure. At the same time, I don't know that I handled everything the way I wish I could have handled, because I was just too young and immature and there was nobody. I mean, all the people that were older than I was who could have been my mentors were generally competitive with me.
And
or dysfunctional.
You know, and I love being a mentor when I can. I love the fact that people would call me, and people do call me from all over. I love that thing. But you were the kind of person, I don't think, that asked. You were a paradox, because here you were in the office fighting, pushing, going, doing whatever. But when it came to yourself, you would never ask for yourself.
You know, I didn't have a happy childhood, and my parents weren't that involved with me. So, you know, I just didn't, nothing, and I didn't have an older sibling or anything like that. So I never had it set up that, like, you could actually have another person say, let me give you the value of my experience, son.
But you had a moped without a helmet.
That was stupid. I laid that thing down numerous times and almost died so many times. I can't even believe that my father was that irresponsible.
I could be across from Gary Busey right now.
You know what? Very soon you might be, because I've taken some blows to my head, you know, in the past that I'm sure will yield a Gary Busey-like state in the near future for myself.
So talk about Bauer Benedict and how that went and how you moved up the ladder there.
Well, that was really great. You know, because it was what I dreamed about. I went there. They really had very little television business. I mean, they had actors. They had Paul Reiser, who was just developing Mad About You, and they had a couple other people who were doing shows. But it wasn't really a situation where there was that much business going on. And I showed up, and I had these clients, and fortunately, like, all their deals were coming up. So I made a big deal for Gene and Reese to be the number two and then eventually number one showrunners on The Simpsons.
And what happens as an agent when he says your deal is coming up, what happens is, even if you don't have that deal, like, his clients were at ICM. So ICM commissioned their deal up to a certain point. But if the deal and the contract ends, the new agency gets to renegotiate the deal and oftentimes makes the commission on the additional situation, and occasionally, if they fight it the right way, they could get the whole commission on the next deal.
Yeah. And so these guys didn't even think I had anything, and they just figured, why not? Let's give it a shot. And I came in, and I made like $3 million worth of deals immediately. And I had a bunch of other clients too. It's like all of a sudden they realized I had, some feature clients that meant something, like Dave Kep. I think Dave Kep right around that time wrote the screenplay for Jurassic Park, and he became hot. And, you know, it was like a lot of my clients started to break. I mean, literally within the first month, and they were like, whoa, what is this about? And then the other thing was they had this hot receptionist who immediately, as soon as I got there, started flirting with me. And they all, you know, these guys are all been married for a long time and were frustrated in the way that you married people are. And so you know, of course, I started sleeping with her, and they found out about that, and it was like, wow, you're just such a rock star.
Is that advisable to bang away in the office?
No, it's terrible. I think it's terrible and it's wrong, but that's the thing. Like I said, I had no real mentors. I had guys who would be like, you're doing the wrong thing. How great is that? I love you. What was that like? I'm not going to talk about it. Really? I can't believe you're doing her. They're thinking about their, they were inappropriate with her. Really.
Before they thought you were a great agent. Now they thought you were their hero.
It's like I was bringing the money and I was sleeping with the girl that they wish somebody was, that they were sleeping with. It was like, it was crazy. And so they were really great. And I spent a lot of time with them. And on the weekends, I'd go to the track with Marty Bauer. And then we'd all watch football on Sunday. And then about 3 or 4 months later, my nemesis from ICM, Jeremy Zimmer, got fired. And he came over to work there. And I was like, holy shit. I mean, it was literally the best time of my life. I was working
so
for
they
these
didn't
guys.
Consult you.
They appreciated me. They supported me. They really tried to, they helped me sign my clients. I had a car allowance. I bought a Porsche. Like it was my dream. And then all of a sudden the guy who used to really like the schoolyard bully would beat me up in the schoolyard came to work there. And you know what? And I thought about leaving immediately because I just hated him so much. But you know, the good thing was Marty said, we'll make this work out. And, I also realized that part of my dislike for Jeremy was I also wanted his approval and he wouldn't give it to me. And then, you know, so we started working together and he is a very smart guy and a really good agent. And we ended up mostly getting along, I think. And then, you know, other times not getting along. But, you know, it didn't turn out that badly. And from there, my career really started to take off and I got happy.
As always, this has been Industry Standard with me, Barry Katz. And if you like the show, tell all your friends. And if you don't like the show, tell all your friends.
You get all the money, drive that fancy car. All the people love you, 'cause you're going far. Life is for the dreamers. They have all to gain. It's never quite over till it all feels the same. You pick your own poison, dig your own grave. Down in the valley, a fortune.
Thank you for listening to Industry Standard with Barry Katz. If you'd like more info on our schedule of new episodes or how to reach Barry through Twitter, Facebook, or email, go to BarryKatz.com. Before you leave, please take a moment to subscribe to our podcast, leave a comment, and rate it, even if you think it blows. Thank you for your support, and have a great day.
Hey, everybody. Let me remind you one more time about my new blueprint for success. It's a project I've spent months and months working on just to help you jumpstart your comedy career and beat the competition. Whether you want to do stand-up, sketch, improv, acting, writing, producing, directing, radio, social media influencing, or even if you want a career behind the scenes as a manager or agent, Blueprint for Success will give you all the tools you need to take your career to the highest levels. With exclusive interviews, my top 50 commercial-free episodes from Industry Standard, one-on-one coaching with me, and unprecedented access into my knowledge and experience from over 40 years in this crazy business. I guarantee you that with Blueprint for Success, you'll become the creator you've always dreamed of becoming. No one's asking me to do this. I want to do it because I want to help you become truly undeniable. So just go to BarryKatz.com, click on Blueprint for Success, and start your incredible journey today. I truly can't wait to work with you to help you change the trajectory of your comedy career forever.